banking. The sooner you make way for a younger man, the better. No doubt in time I will, said Cedric, as he stood up to face his adversary. But of one thing I'm certain, that young man is no longer going to be you. You'll live to regret this, said Sloane, leaning across the desk and eyeballing the chairman. Don't waste your time threatening me, Sloane. Far bigger men than you have tried and failed, said Cedric, his voice rising with every word. There's only one thing left for you to do, and that's make sure you've cleared your desk and are off the premises within 30 minutes, because if you're not, I'll personally put your belongings out on the pavement for every passerby to see. You'll be hearing from my lawyers, shouted Sloane, as he turned to leave. I don't think so, unless you plan to spend the next few years in prison. Because I can assure you, once this stupid old man has reported your behaviour to the Ethics Committee of the Bank of England, you'll never work in the city again. Sloane turned back, his face as white as a sheet, and like a gambler with only one chip left, spun the wheel for the last time. But I could still make the bank a fortune, if you'll only... 29 minutes! Shouted Cedric, trying to control his temper, as he lurched forward and grabbed the edge of his desk. Sloane didn't move as the chairman pulled open a drawer and took out a small bottle of pills. He fumbled with the safety cap, but lost his grip and dropped the bottle onto his desk. They both watched as it rolled onto the floor. Cedric attempted to fill a glass with water, but he no longer had the strength to pick up the jug. I need your help, he slurred, looking up at Sloane, who just stood there, watching him carefully. Cedric stumbled, took a pace backwards, and fell heavily on the floor, gasping for breath. Sloane walked slowly around the desk, his eyes never leaving the chairman as he lay on the floor, fighting for his life. He picked up the bottle and unscrewed the cap. Cedric stared up at him as he shook the pills onto the floor, just out of his reach. He then wiped the empty bottle with a handkerchief from his top pocket and placed it in the chairman's hand. Sloane leant over and listened carefully, to find that the chairman was no longer breathing quite so heavily. Cedric tried to raise his head, but he could only watch helplessly as Sloane gathered up all the papers on his desk that he'd been working on for the past 24 hours. Sloane turned and walked slowly away, without once looking back, avoiding those eyes that were burning into him. He opened the door and looked out into the corridor. No one in sight. He closed the door quietly behind him and went in search of the chairman's secretary. Her hat and coat were no longer on the stand, so he assumed she must have left for the weekend. He tried to remain calm as he walked down the corridor, but beads of sweat were pouring off his forehead and he could feel his heart pounding. He stood for a moment and listened, like a bloodhound sniffing for danger. He decided to throw the dice once again. Anyone around? He shouted. His voice echoed through the high-ceilinged corridor as if it were a concert hall, but there was no response. He checked the executive offices one by one, but they were all locked. No one on the top floor, other than Cedric, would still be in the office at 6 o'clock on a Friday evening. Sloane knew there would still be junior staff in the building who wouldn't think of leaving before their bosses, but none of them would consider disturbing the chairman, and the cleaners wouldn't be returning until 5 o'clock on Monday morning. That only left Stanley, the night porter, who would never budge from his comfortable chair at the front desk unless the building was on fire. Sloane took the lift to the ground floor, and as he crossed the lobby, he noticed that Stanley was dozing quietly. He didn't disturb him. The Rijksmuseum, said Sam as they entered the Dutch National Gallery, houses one of the finest collections on earth. The Rembrandts are showstoppers, but the Vermeers, De Witts, and Steens are also among the finest examples of the Dutch masters you'll ever see. Hand in hand, they made their way slowly around the Grand Gallery, Sam often stopping to point out a character or a feature of a particular work, without ever once referring to her guidebook. Whenever heads turned, and they often did, Seb wanted to shout, "And she's bright, too!" At the far end of the gallery stood a small crowd admiring a single work. The Night Watch, said Sam, is a masterpiece and probably Rembrandt's best-known work. Although sadly we'll never know what the original looked like because the city council later trimmed the painting to fit between two columns in the town hall. They should have knocked down the columns, said Seb, unable to take his eyes off the group of figures surrounding a finely dressed man carrying a lantern. Pity you weren't on the town council, said Sam as they walked into the next room. And here's a painting that will feature in my PhD thesis, she continued, as they stopped in front of a large canvas. It's hard to believe that Rubens completed the work in a weekend, because he had to attend the signing of a peace treaty between the English and Spanish on the following Monday. Most people are quite unaware that he was a diplomat as well as an artist, she said, before moving on. Seb felt he ought to be taking notes, but his mind was on other things. This is one of my favorites, said Sam, stopping in front of the Arnolfini wedding. I've seen that somewhere else, said Seb. Ah, so you do listen to me occasionally. You saw it when we visited the National Gallery last year. So what's it doing here? It's probably on loan, said Sam. But only for another month, she added, after taking a closer look at the label on the wall beside the portrait. But more important, do you remember what I told you about it at the time? Yes, it's the wedding of a wealthy merchant, and Van Eyck must have been commissioned to record the event. Not bad, said Sam. So really, Van Eyck was just doing the job of a modern-day wedding photographer. Seb was about to say something, but she added, Look at the texture of the bride's dress, and the fur on the lapels on the groom's coat. You can almost feel it. The bride looks heavily pregnant to me. How observant of you, Seb. But any wealthy man at the time had to be sure that the woman he'd chosen to be his wife was capable of producing an heir to inherit his fortune. What a practical lot those Dutch were, said Seb. But what if you weren't rich? The lower classes were expected to behave more properly. Seb fell on one knee in front of the painting, looked up at Sam and said, Samantha Ethel Sullivan, I adore you and always will, and more than anything on earth, I want you to be my wife. Sam blushed, and bending down whispered, Get up, you idiot. Everyone's staring at us. Not until you've answered my question. A small group of visitors had stopped looking at the paintings and were waiting for her reply. Of course I'll marry you, she said. I've loved you since the day you got me arrested. Several of the onlookers, looking rather puzzled, tried to translate her words. Seb stood up, took out a small red leather box from his jacket pocket, and presented it to her. When Sam opened the box and saw the exquisite blue sapphire surrounded by a cluster of little diamonds, she was for once lost for words. Seb took out the ring and placed it on the third finger of her left hand. When he leant forward to kiss his fiancée, he was greeted with a round of applause. As they walked away, hand in hand, Samantha glanced back at the painting and wondered if she ought to tell him. Chapter 12.
May I ask what time you left the office on Friday evening, sir?
It must have been around 6 o'clock, Inspector, said Sloane.
And what time was your appointment with Mr. Hardcastle?
5. We always met at 5 on the last Friday of the month to go over my department's figures.
And when you left him, did he seem in good spirits?
Never better, said Sloane. My monthly results were up by 2.2%, and I was able to tell him the details of a new project I'd been working on that he became very excited about.
It's just that the pathologist has put the time of death at around 6 o'clock on Friday evening. So you must have been the last person to see him alive.
If that's the case, I only wish our meeting had lasted a little longer, said Sloane.
Quite so. Did Mr. Hardcastle take any pills while you were with him?
No, and although we all knew Cedric had a heart problem, he made a point of not taking his medication in front of members of staff.
It seems odd that his pills were scattered randomly over the floor of his office while the empty bottle was in his hand. Why wasn't he able to get hold of at least one of the pills? Sloane said nothing. And Stanley Davis, the night porter, told me that you phoned in on Saturday morning to check if a package had arrived for you.
Yes, I did. I needed a particular document for a meeting that was scheduled for Monday morning.
And did it arrive?
Yes, but not until this morning.
Mr. Davis tells me he's never known you to telephone on a Saturday morning before.
Sloane didn't rise to the bait.
The pathologist has issued a death certificate concluding that Mr. Hardcastle died of a heart attack, which I have no doubt the coroner will confirm at the inquest.
Still, Sloane said nothing.
Can I assume that you'll be around for the next few days, Mr. Sloane? Should I have any more questions?
Yes, you can, although I was planning to travel up to Huddersfield tomorrow to pay my respects to Mr. Hardcastle's widow and to see if there's anything I can do to help with the funeral arrangements.
How very thoughtful of you. Well, I only have one or two more people to interview, Mr. Sloane, and then I'll be on my way.
Sloane waited for the inspector to leave his office and close the door behind him before he picked up the phone. I need those documents ready for signature by close of business today.
I've got a team working on them right now, sir.
Sloane's second call was to Ralph Vaughan at Savills, who passed on his condolences, but didn't go into the details of his conversation with Cedric Hardcastle on Friday afternoon.
And like you, said Sloane, our thoughts are with Cedric and his family at this time. But the last thing he said to me on Friday evening was to be sure we closed the Shifnal Farm deal.
But surely you know he withdrew the bank's offer on Friday afternoon, which was embarrassing, to say the least.
That was before I was able to brief him on the full details, and I know he had intended to call you first thing this morning.
If that's the case, I'm willing to extend the deadline for one more week, but no more, emphasised Vaughan.
That's good of you, Ralph, and be assured the deposit of $160,000 will be with you later today, and we'll just have to wait and see if anyone outbids me.
I can't imagine anyone will, said Vaughan. But I must ask if you have the authority to make an offer of $1.6 million on behalf of the bank.
It's no more than my duty to see that Cedric's final wishes are carried out, said Sloane, before putting down the phone.
Sloane's third and fourth calls were to two of the bank's major shareholders, who said they would back him, but only if Mrs. Hardcastle went along with his proposal.
I'll have the documents on your desk ready for signature by close of business tomorrow, he assured them.
Sloane's fifth call was to the Bank of Zurich in Switzerland. Seb phoned his mother from the office that morning and told her the news.
I'm so sorry, said Emma. I know how much you admired Cedric. I can't help thinking that my days at Farthing's are numbered, especially if Adrian Sloane takes Cedric's place. Just keep your head down, and remember it's quite hard to sack someone who's doing a good job. You clearly haven't met Sloane. He would have sacked Wellington on the morning of Waterloo if it would have guaranteed he became a general. Don't forget that Ross Buchanan is still the deputy chairman and the most likely candidate to replace Cedric. I hope you're right, said Seb. I'm sure Cedric kept Ross well briefed on Sloane's activities. And please let me know when and where the funeral will take place, as your father and I will want to attend.
I'm so sorry to trouble you at a time like this, Mrs. Hardcastle, but we both know that Cedric would have expected nothing less of me.
Beryl Hardcastle drew her woolen shawl tightly around her and shrank back, almost disappearing into the large leather armchair.
What do you need me to do?
She whispered.
Nothing too demanding, said Sloane. Just a couple of documents that need to be signed, and then I know the Reverend Johnson is waiting to take you through the order of service. His only concern is that the church won't be large enough to accommodate the local community, as well as all Cedric's friends and colleagues, who will be travelling up from London on Thursday.
He wouldn't have wanted them to miss a day's work for his sake, said Beryl.
I didn't have the heart to stop them.
That's very considerate of you.
It's no more than he deserves, said Sloane.
But there is still one small matter that needs to be dealt with.
He extracted three thick documents from his briefcase.
I just need your signature, so the bank can carry on with its day-to-day business. Can it wait until this afternoon?
Asked Beryl.
My son Arnold is on his way up from London. As you probably know, he's a QC, and he usually advises me on any matters concerning the bank.
I fear not, said Sloane. I'll have to take the 2 o'clock train back to London if I'm to keep all the appointments Mr. Hardcastle had scheduled. If it would help, I'll happily send copies of the documents round to Arnold's chambers as soon as I get back to the bank.
He took her by the hand.
I just need three signatures, Mrs. Hardcastle. But by all means, read through the documents if you are in any doubt.
I suppose it will be all right,
Beryl said, taking the pen Sloane handed to her and making no attempt to read the densely typed small print. Sloane left the room and asked the vicar to join them. He then knelt down beside Mrs. Hardcastle, turned to the last page of the first document, and placed a finger on the dotted line. Beryl signed all three documents in the presence of the Reverend Johnson, who innocently witnessed her signature.
I look forward to seeing you again on Thursday, said Sloane,
getting up off his knees.
When we will recall with admiration and gratitude all that Cedric achieved in his remarkable life.
He left the old lady with the vicar.
Mr. Clifton, can you tell me where you were at 5 o'clock on Friday evening?
I was in Amsterdam with my girlfriend, Samantha, visiting the Rice Museum.
When did you last see Mr. Cedric Hardcastle?
I went to his home in Cadogan Place just after 8 on Thursday evening, having returned from Shifnal in Shropshire.
May I ask why Mr. Hardcastle wanted you to visit him outside working hours, when you could have seen him at the office the following morning?
Sebastian spent a little time considering his response, well aware that all he needed to say was that it was a private matter concerning the bank, and the inspector would have to move on.
I was checking on a deal, where the chairman had reason to believe that a senior member of staff had been working behind his back.
And did you discover that the person concerned was working behind Mr. Hardcastle's back?
Yes, I did.
Was that senior member of staff Mr. Adrian Sloane, by any chance?
Seb remained silent.
What was Mr. Hardcastle's attitude after you told him what you'd found out?
He warned me that he intended to sack the person concerned the following day, and advised me to be as far away from the office as possible when he did so.
Because he was going to sack your boss.
Which is why I was in Amsterdam on Friday evening, said Seb,
ignoring the question.
Which I now regret.
Why?
Because if I'd gone to the office that day, I just might have been able to save Mr. Hardcastle.
Do you believe Mr. Sloane would have saved him, faced with the same circumstances?
My father always says that a policeman should never ask a hypothetical question.
Not all of us can solve every crime quite as easily as Inspector Warwick.
Do you think Sloane murdered Mr. Hardcastle?
Asked Seb.
No, I don't, said the inspector. Although it's just possible that he could have saved his life. But even Inspector Warwick would find that hard to prove.
The Right Reverend Ashley Tadworth, Bishop of Huddersfield, climbed the half-dozen steps and took his place in the pulpit during the last verse of Abide with Me. He looked down at the packed congregation and waited until everyone was settled. Some, who hadn't been able to find a seat, were standing in the aisles, while others, who'd arrived late, were crammed together at the back of the church. It was a mark of the man.
Funerals are naturally sad events, began the bishop. even more so when the departed has achieved little more than leading a blameless life, which can make delivering their eulogy a difficult task. That was not my problem when I prepared my address on the life, the exemplary life, of Cedric Arthur Hardcastle. If you were to liken Cedric's life to a bank statement, he left this world with every account in credit. Where do I begin to tell you the unlikely tale of this remarkable Yorkshireman? Cedric left school at the age of 15 and joined his father at Farthing's Bank. He always called his father Sir, both at work and at home. In fact, his father retired just in time not to have to call his son Sir. A little laughter broke out among the congregation. Cedric began his working life as a junior trainee. 2 years later, he became a teller, even before he was old enough to open a bank account. From there, he progressed to under-manager, branch manager, and later area controller, before becoming the youngest director in the bank's history. And frankly, no one was surprised when he became chairman of the bank at the age of 42, a position he held for the past 23 years, during which time he took Farthing's from being a local bank in a small town in Yorkshire to one of the most respected financial institutions in the City of London. But something that would not have changed, even if Cedric had become chairman of the Bank of England, was his constant refrain that if you take care of the pennies, the pounds will take care of themselves.
"Do you think we've got away with it?" asked Sloane nervously.
"If by that you're asking if everything you've done in the past 4 days is legal and above board, the answer is yes."
"Do we have a quorum?"
"We do," said Malcolm Atkins, the bank's chief legal adviser. "The managing director, the company secretary, and 6 non-executive directors are waiting for you in the boardroom. Mind you," he added, "I'd be fascinated to know what you said to them when they suggested that perhaps they ought to be attending a funeral in Huddersfield today rather than a board meeting in London."
"I told them quite simply that the choice was theirs. They could vote for a place in this world or the next."
Atkins smiled and checked his watch. "We should join them. It's almost 10. The two men left Sloane's office and walked silently down the thickly carpeted corridor. When Sloane entered the boardroom, everyone stood, just as they'd always done for the late chairman.
"Gentlemen," said the company secretary once they had all settled, "this extraordinary meeting has been called for one purpose, namely..."
"Whenever we think of Cedric Hardcastle," continued the bishop, "we should remember one thing above all. He was quintessentially a Yorkshireman. If the second coming had taken place at Headingley during the tea interval of a Roses match, he would not have been surprised. It was Cedric's unswerving belief that Yorkshire was a country, not a county. In fact, he considered Farthing's Bank to have become international not when he opened a branch in Hong Kong, but when he opened one in Manchester." He waited for the laughter to die down before he continued. "Cedric was not a vain man, but that didn't stop him being a proud one. Proud of the bank he served every day, and even prouder of how many customers and staff had prospered under his guidance and leadership. So many of you in this congregation today, from the most junior trainee to the president of Sony International, have been beneficiaries of his wisdom and foresight. But what he will most be remembered for is his unquestionable reputation for honesty, integrity, and decency. Standards he took for granted when dealing with his fellow men. He considered a good deal was one in which both sides made a profit, and would be happy to raise their hats to each other whenever they passed in the street."
"The one item on today's agenda," continued the company secretary, "is for the board to elect a new chairman following the tragic death of Cedric Hardcastle. Only one name has been proposed, that of Mr. Adrian Sloane, the head of our highly profitable property division. Mr. Sloane has already obtained the legal backing of 66% of our shareholders, but he felt his appointment should also be ratified by the board."
Malcolm Atkins came in on cue.
It is my pleasure to propose that Adrian Sloane be the next chairman of Farthing's Bank, as I feel that is what Cedric would have wanted.
I'm delighted to second that motion, said Desmond Mellor, a recently appointed non-executive director.
Those in favour, said the company secretary.
8 hands shot up.
I declare the motion carried unanimously.
Sloane rose slowly to his feet.
Gentlemen, allow me to begin by thanking you for the confidence you have shown by electing me as the next chairman of Farthing's. Cedric Harcastle's shoes are not easy ones to step into. I replace a man who left us in tragic circumstances. A man we all assumed would be with us for many years to come. A man I could not have admired more. A man I considered not only a colleague, but a friend, which makes me all the more proud to pick up his baton and carry it on the next leg of the bank's race. I respectfully suggest that we all rise and bow our heads in memory of a great man.
But ultimately, continued the bishop, Cedric Hardcastle would be best remembered as a family man. He loved Beryl from the day she gave him an extra third of a pint when she was the milk monitor at their primary school in Huddersfield, and he could not have been more proud when their only son, Arnold, became a QC, although he could never understand why the lad had chosen Oxford and not Leeds to complete his education. Allow me to end by summing up my feelings for one of my oldest and dearest friends, with the words from the epitaph on Sir Thomas Fairfax by the Duke of Buckingham. He never knew what envy was nor hate. His soul was filled with worth and honesty, and with another thing besides, quite out of date, called modesty.
Malcolm Atkins raised a glass of champagne.
To the new chairman of Farthing's, he toasted,
as Sloane sat in the chair behind Cedric's desk for the first time.
So, what will be your first executive action?
Make sure we close the Shifnal deal before anyone else works out why it's so cheap at 1.6 million.
And your second? Asked Mellor.
Sack Sebastian Clifton, he spat out,
along with anyone else who was close to Hardcastle and went along with his outdated philosophy.
This bank is about to join the real world, where profits, not people, will be its only mantra.
And if any customers threaten to move their account, let them, especially if they're from Yorkshire. From now on, the bank's motto will be, if you've only got pennies, don't bother to bank with us.
Sebastian bowed his head as the pallbearers lowered the coffin into the grave, so no one would see his tears. Ross Buchanan didn't attempt to hide his feelings. Emma and Harry held hands. They had all lost a good and wise friend. As they walked slowly away from the graveside, Arnold Hardcastle and his mother joined them.
Why wasn't Adrian Sloane here? Asked Ross. Not to mention half a dozen other directors.
Father wouldn't have missed Sloane, said Arnold. He was just about to sack him before he died.
He told you that, said Ross.
Yes. He rang me early on Friday morning to find out what the legal position was if the head of a department was caught using the bank's money to carry out private deals.
Did he say which head of department?
Asked Ross. He didn't need to.
Did you say 6 directors?
Interrupted Emma.
Yes, said Ross. Why is that important?
It constitutes a quorum. If Cedric was still alive, he would have spotted what Sloane was up to.
Oh, my God. Now I realize why he needed me to sign those documents, said Beryl. Cedric will never forgive me.
Like you, I'm appalled, Mother, but don't worry. You still own 51% of the bank.
Can someone kindly explain in simple English, asked Harry, what you're all talking about?
Adrian Sloane
has just appointed himself as the new chairman of Farthings, said Sebastian. Where's the nearest phone?
Chapter 13. Sebastian checked his watch. Just enough time to make one call. He was relieved to find the only phone box within sight was empty and wasn't out of order. He dialed a number he knew by heart.
Victor Kaufman.
Vic, it's Seb.
Seb, hi. You sound as if you're phoning from the other side of the world.
Not quite. I'm at Huddersfield Station. I've just been to Cedric Harcastle's funeral.
I read his obituary in today's FT. That was one hell of a man you were working for.
You don't know the half of it, which is why I'm calling. I need to see your father urgently.
Just give his secretary a call, and I'll make sure she fixes an appointment.
What I want to discuss can't wait. I need to see him this evening, tomorrow morning at the latest.
Am I sensing a big deal?
The biggest ever to cross my desk.
Then I'll speak to him immediately. When will you be back in London?
My train's due to arrive at Euston at 4:10.
Give me a call from the station and I'll...
A shrill whistle blew, and Seb turned to see a green flag waving. He dropped the phone, ran out onto the platform, and jumped onto the moving train. He took a seat at the rear of the carriage, and once he'd got his breath back, he thought about how he'd first met Vic at St. Bede's, when he'd shared a study with him and Bruno Martinez, and they had become his two closest friends, one the son of an immigrant Jew, and the other the son of an Argentinian arms dealer. Over the years, they'd become inseparable. That friendship grew even closer when Seb had ended up with a black eye for defending his Jewish friend, not that he'd been altogether sure what a Jew was. Like a blind man unaware of race or religion, he quickly discovered that prejudice was often taught at the breakfast table. He turned his attention to the sage advice his mother had given him just before she and Dad had driven back to Bristol after the funeral. He knew she was right. Seb took his time writing a first draft, then a second. By the time the train pulled into Euston, he'd completed a final draft, which he hoped would meet with both his mother's and Cedric's approval. Sloane immediately recognised the handwriting. He tore open the envelope and pulled out a letter, becoming angrier with each word he read.
Dear Mr. Sloane, I cannot believe that even you could stoop so low as to hold a board meeting on the day of Cedric Hardcastle's funeral, with the sole purpose of appointing yourself chairman. Unlike me, Cedric would probably not have been surprised by your duplicity. You may think you've got away with it, but I can assure you, you haven't, because I will not rest until you are exposed for the fraud you are. As we both know, you are the last person Cedric would have wanted to succeed him. After reading this letter, you won't be surprised to learn that I no longer want to work for an amoral charlatan like you. S. Clifton.
Sloane leapt out of his chair, unable to control his temper. He charged into his secretary's office and shouted,
"Is he still in the building?"
"Who?"
asked Rachel innocently.
"Clifton, who else?"
"I haven't seen him since he handed me a letter and asked me to put it on your desk."
Sloane marched out of his office and down the corridor, still hoping to find Clifton at his desk so he could publicly sack him.
"Where's Clifton?"
he demanded as he strode into Sebastian's room. Bobby Rushton, Seb's young assistant, looked up at the new chairman and was so petrified he couldn't get any words out.
"Are you deaf?"
said Sloane.
"Didn't you hear what I said? Where's Clifton?"
"He packed his things and left a few minutes ago," said Rushton. "He told us all that he'd resigned and wouldn't be back."
"Only minutes before, he would have been sacked," said Sloane.
Looking down at the young man, he added,
"And you can join him. Make sure you're off the premises within the hour, and be certain you leave nothing in this room that even hints that Clifton ever existed."
Sloane stormed back to his office and sat down at his desk. Five more envelopes, all marked personal, were waiting to be opened.
"I only met Cedric Hardcastle on half a dozen occasions, mostly social," said Saul Kaufman. "We never did any business, but I'd have liked to. because he was one of the few men in the city who still believed a handshake closed a deal, not a contract.
Even a contract won't necessarily close a deal with the new chairman, said Seb.
I've never met Adrian Sloane. I only know him by reputation. Is he the reason you wanted to see me so urgently?
Yes, sir, said Seb. I was looking into a major deal involving Sloane when the chairman had his heart attack.
Then take me through the deal slowly, and don't leave out any details.
Seb began by telling Mr. Kaufman how he'd taken a phone call from Ralph Vaughan of Savills that had alerted him to what Sloane was up to, and how the following morning, on Cedric's instructions, he'd travelled up to Shifnal, and how the day had ended with him meeting Mr. Swan and discovering why Sloane was willing to pay way over the odds for a 1,000-acre farm in Shropshire. When Seb came to the end of his story, an enigmatic smile appeared on Kaufman's face.
Could it be possible that Mr. Swan has stumbled across something we all missed? We'll find out soon enough, because the government is expected to announce its findings in the next few weeks.
But we haven't got weeks, only a couple of days. Don't forget, closing bids have to be in by 5 o'clock tomorrow.
So you want me to outbid Sloane on the possibility that Mr. Swan has worked out what the government has planned?
Cedric was willing to take that risk.
And unlike Sloane, Cedric Hardcastle had the reputation of being a cautious man.
Kaufman placed his hands together as if in prayer, and when his prayer was answered, he said,
I'll need to make a few phone calls before I come to a final decision, so come back to my office at 4:40 tomorrow afternoon. If I'm convinced, we'll take it from there.
But by then it will be too late.
I don't think so, said Kaufman.
When Seb left the bank, he was in a daze, and not at all convinced that Kaufman would go ahead with the deal. But he had nowhere else to turn. He hurried home. He wanted to share everything that had happened since he'd left the flat that morning with Samantha. She always saw things from a different angle, often coming out of left field, to use one of her favourite American expressions. While Sam prepared supper, Seb told her who'd attended the funeral that morning, and more important, who hadn't, and what Sloane and his cronies had been up to while he was in Huddersfield, and why he was now looking for a job. When he finally stopped pacing around the kitchen and sat down, Sam said,
But you've always known Sloane was a crook, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise that he'd call a board meeting when everyone who would have opposed him was out of town. I bet your mother would have worked that one out. She did, but by then it was too late. But I still think we can beat Sloane at his own game. Not at his own game, said Sam. Try to think what Cedric would have done in the circumstances, not Sloane. But if I'm ever going to beat him, I'll have to think like him. Possibly, but that doesn't mean you have to act like him. Shifnal Farm is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. That's not a good enough reason to crawl around in the same gutter as Sloane. But Sam, I might never get another chance like this again. Of course you will, Seb. Think long term, and you'll understand the difference between Adrian Sloane and Cedric Hardcastle. Because I'm absolutely sure of one thing. Very few people will be attending Sloane's funeral.
Friday turned out to be the longest day of Sebastian's life. He'd hardly slept the previous night as he tried to work out what Kaufman was up to. When Sam left to attend a lecture at King's, he pottered around the flat, pretended to read a morning paper, spent an inordinate amount of time washing up the few breakfast dishes, even went for a run in the park, but by the time he got back, it was still only just after 11. He took a shower, shaved, and opened a tin of baked beans. He continually glanced at his watch, but the second hand still only circled the dial every 60 seconds. After what passed for a fork lunch, he went upstairs to the bedroom, took his smartest suit out of the wardrobe, and put on a freshly ironed white shirt and his old school tie. He finally polished a pair of shoes until a sergeant major would have been proud of them. At 4 o'clock, he was standing at the bus stop waiting for the number 4 to take him into the city. He jumped off at St. Paul's and, although he walked slowly, He was standing outside Kaufman's Bank on Cheapside by 4:25. There was nothing for it but to stroll around the block. As he walked past so many familiar city institutions, he was reminded just how much he enjoyed working in the Square Mile. He tried not to think about being unemployed for any length of time. At 4:38, Seb marched into the bank and said to the receptionist, "I have an appointment with Mr. Kaufman." "Which Mr. Kaufman?" she asked, giving him a warm smile. "The chairman." "Thank you, sir. If you'd like to take a seat, I'll let him know you're here." Seb paced around the lobby, watching another second hand make a larger circle around a larger clock, but with exactly the same result. His thoughts were interrupted by a tap on his shoulder, and the words,
"The chairman is waiting for us in his office. I'll take you up."
Seb was impressed that Vic hadn't said Dad. He could feel the palms of his hands sweating, and as the lift trundled slowly up to the top floor, he rubbed them on his trousers. When they entered the chairman's office, they found Mr. Kaufman on the phone.
"I need to speak to a colleague before I can make that decision, Mr. Sloan. I'll call you back around 5.
Seb looked horrified, but Kaufman put a finger to his lips.
"If that's convenient."
Sloan put the receiver down, picked it up again immediately, and without going through to his secretary, dialed a number.
"Ralph, it's Adrian Sloan."
"I thought it might be," said Vaughan, checking his watch. "You'll be pleased to hear that no one has called about Shifnal Farm all day. So with just 15 minutes to go, I think it's safe to assume the property is yours. I'll give you a call just after 5, so we can discuss how you want to deal with the paperwork."
"That's fine by me," said Sloan. "But don't be surprised if my line's engaged when you call, because I'm currently involved in a deal that's even bigger than Shifnal Farm."
"But if someone was to make a bid between now and 5,
"That isn't going to happen," said Sloan. "Just make sure you send the contract round to Farthing's first thing on Monday morning. There'll be a cheque waiting for you."
"It's 10 to 5, said Vic.
"Patience, child," said the old man. "There is only one thing that matters when you're trying to close a deal. Timing."
He leant back and closed his eyes, although he was wide awake. He had told his secretary that under no circumstances was he to be disturbed between 10 to 5 and 10 past. Neither Vic nor Seb said another word. Suddenly Saul's eyes opened and he sat bolt upright. He checked that the two phones on his desk were placed exactly where he wanted them. At 6 minutes to 5, he leaned forward and picked up the black phone. He dialed the number of an estate agent in Mayfair and asked to speak to the senior partner.
"Mr. Kaufman, this is an unexpected pleasure," said Vaughan. "How can I help you?"
"You can start by telling me the time, Mr. Vaughan."
"I make it 5 to 5, said a puzzled voice. "Why do you ask?"
"Because I wanted to be sure that you're still open for bids on Shifnal Farm in Shropshire."
"We most certainly are. But I must warn you that we already have an offer of £1.6 million from another bank."
"Then I bid £1,610,000.
"Thank you, sir," said Vaughan.
"And what time do you make it now?"
3 minutes to 5.
"Please hold on, Mr. Vaughan. There's someone on the other line. I'll only be a moment."
Kaufman placed the black receiver on his desk, picked up the red one, and dialed a number. After 3 rings, a voice said,
"Adrian Sloan."
"Mr. Sloan, I'm calling back about the Nigerian oil bonds your bank is offering to selected investors. As I said earlier, it sounds a most exciting opportunity. What is the maximum amount that you'll allow any one institution to invest?"
£2 million, Mr. Kaufman.
I'd offer you more, but the majority of the shares have already been taken up."
"Can you just hold on while I consult one of my colleagues?"
"Of course, Mr. Kaufman."
Saul placed the red phone back on his desk and picked up the black one.
"I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. Vaughan, but I must ask you once again, what time do you make it?"
1 minute to 5.
"Excellent. Would you now be kind enough to open your office door?"
Kaufman put the black receiver back down on his desk and picked up the red one,
My colleague is asking if we were to invest the full 2 million, would that entitle us to a place on the board of the new company?
Most certainly, said Sloane. In fact, I could offer you 2 places, as you would own 10% of the stock.
Allow me to consult my colleague again.
The red phone was placed back on the desk, and Kaufman picked up the black one.
What did you find when you opened the door, Mr. Vaughan?
A messenger handed me an envelope containing a banker's draft for £161,000.
The 10% required to close the transaction.
What time do you make it now, Mr. Vaughan?
5:02.
Then the deal is closed, and as long as I pay the remaining 90% within 30 days, Shifnal Farm is mine.
It most certainly is, said Vaughan, unwilling to admit how much he was looking forward to telling Sloane that he'd lost the deal.
Have a good weekend,
said Kaufman, as he placed the black phone back on its cradle and returned to the red one.
Mr. Sloane, I want to invest £2 million in this most exciting project.
Kaufman wished he could see the look on Sloane's face.
But unfortunately, I couldn't get my colleagues to agree with me. So sadly, I'll have to withdraw my offer. As you assured me, the majority of the shares have already been taken up. I don't suppose that will cause you too much of a problem.
Chapter 14. Sebastian didn't tell Samantha the tactics Mr. Kaufman had resorted to in order to close the Shifnal Farm deal, because he knew she wouldn't approve, even though it was Sloane who'd lost out. What he did tell her was that Kaufman had offered him a job.
But I thought his bank didn't have a property division.
It does now, said Seb.
He's asked me to set up my own department. Small transactions to begin with, but with a view to expanding, if I prove myself.
That's wonderful news, said Sam, giving him a hug.
And it shouldn't be too difficult to pick up good staff, since Sloane sacked my entire team, not to mention several others who've resigned, including Rachel.
Rachel?
She used to be Cedric's secretary, but she only lasted a week under the new regime. I've asked her to join me. We start on Monday with a clean sheet. Well, not exactly a clean sheet, because Sloane sacked my assistant and ordered him to remove everything from the office that even hinted of me. So he gathered up all the files I was working on, walked across to Cheapside, and handed them to me.
Is that legal?
Who gives a damn when Sloane's never going to find out?
Frithing's bank is not just Adrian Sloane, and you still have an obligation to it.
After the way Sloane treated me?
No, after the way Cedric treated you.
But that doesn't apply to Shifnal Farm, because Sloane was working behind Cedric's back on that deal.
And now you're working behind his.
You bet I am, if it's going to make it possible for us to buy a flat in Chelsea.
We shouldn't be thinking about buying anything until you've paid off all your debts.
Mr. Kaufman has promised me a £40,000 bonus when the government makes its announcement, so I won't have any debts then.
If the government makes an announcement, said Sam. Don't start spending the money before you've got it. And even if you do pull the deal off, you'll still owe Mr. Swan over £8,000. So perhaps we ought not to be thinking about moving quite yet.
That was something else Seb decided he wasn't going to tell Sam about. Seb spent the next few weeks working hours that would have impressed even Cedric, and with the help of Rachel and his old team from Farthing's, they were up and running far more quickly than Mr. Kaufman would have thought possible. Seb wasn't satisfied with just being reunited with his old customers, but like a marauding pirate, he began to plunder several of Farthing's other clients, convincing himself that it was no more than Sloane deserved. It was about 3 months after he began working at Kaufman's that the chairman called him into his office.
Did you read the Financial Times this morning?
He said, even before Seb had closed the door.
Only the front page and the property section. Why?
Because we're about to find out if Mr. Swan's prediction is correct.
Seb didn't interrupt Kaufman's flow.
It seems the Transport Minister will be making a statement in the House at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Perhaps you and Victor should go along and hear what he has to say. Then call and let me know if I've made or lost a fortune.
As soon as Seb returned to his office, he called Uncle Giles at the Commons and asked if he could arrange a couple of tickets for the Strangers' Gallery that afternoon, so he and a friend could hear the statement by the Minister of Transport.
"I'll leave them in Central Lobby," said Giles.
After he put the phone down, Giles studied the order paper and wondered why Sebastian would be interested in a decision that would only affect a handful of people living in Shropshire. Seb and Vic were seated in the fourth row of the Strangers' Gallery long before the minister rose to deliver his statement. Uncle Giles smiled up at them from the government benches, still puzzled as to what would be in the statement that could possibly be of any interest to his nephew. The two young bankers were sitting on the edge of the green leather bench when the speaker called for the Secretary of State for Transport to deliver his statement to the House.
"Mr. Speaker," the minister began, as he gripped the dispatch box, "I rise to inform the House which route has been selected by my department for the proposed motorway extension that will run through the county of Shropshire."
If the word silence hadn't been displayed in bold on the wood-panelled walls, Seb would have leapt in the air when the minister referred to the outskirts of Shifnal, including Shifnal Farm, as a section of the route for the proposed new motorway. Once the minister had dealt with several questions from local members, he resumed his place on the front bench to allow debate on foreign affairs to begin. Seb and Vic had no interest in whether the government intended to impose economic sanctions on South Africa, so they slipped quietly out of the Strangers' Gallery, made their way downstairs to the central lobby and out onto Parliament Square. That's when Seb leapt in the air and screamed, "We did it!" Samantha was reading The Guardian when a sleepy Sebastian appeared for breakfast the following morning.
"Where were you last night?" she asked. "I didn't even hear you come in."
"Vic and I were out celebrating. Sorry, I should have called to let you know."
"Celebrating what?"
asked Sam. But Seb didn't answer as he helped himself to a bowl of cornflakes.
"Could it possibly be that Mr. Swan worked out that the new motorway would go straight through the middle of Shifnal Farm and, to quote The Guardian," said Sam, looking down at the article in front of her, "make a small fortune for a handful of speculators?"
She handed the newspaper to Seb, who only glanced at the headline.
"You have to understand," said Seb, between mouthfuls, "this means we'll now have enough money to buy a house in Chelsea." "But will there be enough money left over for Mr. Swan to build his theatre in Shifnal?"
"That depends."
"On what?" "You gave him your word that if the information he supplied turned out to be correct, you would pay him the £8,234 he needed to complete his theatre."
"But I only earn $4,000 a year, protested Seb.
"And you're about to be given a bonus of $40,000,
on which I'll have to pay capital gains tax.
Not on a charitable donation, you won't."
"But there was nothing in writing."
"Seb, did you hear what you just said?"
"In any case," added Seb quickly, "it's Mr. Kaufman who will make the small fortune, not me."
"And it was Mr. Kaufman who took the risk in the first place and could have lost a small fortune, whereas you had nothing to lose and everything to gain."
"You don't understand," began Seb.
"I understand only too well," said Sam,
as Seb pushed his bowl aside and got up from the table.
"I ought to be going," he said. "I'm already late and I've got a lot to do today. Like deciding how to spend the money Mr. Swan has made for you."
He leant down to kiss her, but she turned away.
"The truth is, you never had any intention of paying Mr. Swan, did you?"
Seb made no attempt to answer her question, as he turned and walked quickly towards the door.
"Can't you see that if you don't pay Mr. Swan, you'll be just as bad as Adrian Sloane?"
said Sam with feeling. Seb didn't reply as he picked up his briefcase and hurried out of the flat without saying goodbye. Once he was safely out on the street, he hailed a taxi. As it made its way along City Road, he began to wonder how long it would be before, like Saul Kaufman, he had his own car and driver.
but his mind kept returning to Sam and her words, "You'll be just as bad as Adrian Sloane." He would book a table for two at the Mirabelle tonight, when they would talk about anything but banking. During his lunch break, he would visit Mr. Gard in Hatton Garden and buy that marcasite brooch. Then surely Sam would begin to appreciate the advantages of being engaged to Sebastian Clifton.
"Your usual table, Mr. Kaufman?"
Seb wondered how long it would be before the head waiter would say to him, "Your usual table, Mr. Clifton?" Over lunch in the grill room, he told the chairman he'd already spotted one or two other properties whose sellers seemed unaware of their true value. After a lunch, at which he'd drunk a little too much, he took a taxi to Hatton Garden. Mr. Gard opened the safe and pulled out the third tray from the top. Seb was delighted to see it was still there, a Victorian marcasite brooch surrounded by diamonds that he was sure Sam would find irresistible. In the taxi on his way back to Islington, he felt confident that over dinner at the Mirabelle, he could bring her round to his way of thinking. When he put the key in the lock, his first thought was, "We won't be living here much longer." But when he opened the door, he was puzzled to find that all the lights were out. Could Sam be attending an evening lecture? The moment he switched on the light, he sensed that something was wrong. Something was missing, but what? He sobered up instantly when he realized that several personal objects, including the photograph of the two of them in Central Park, one of Jessica's drawings, and Sam's print of the night watch, were nowhere to be seen. He rushed through to their bedroom and flung open the cupboards on Sam's side of the bed. Empty. He looked under the bed to find her suitcases were no longer there.
"No, no!"
he screamed as he ran out of the bedroom and into the kitchen, where he saw the envelope. It was propped up against a small red leather box and addressed to Sebastian. He tore it open and pulled out a letter that was written in her strong, bold hand.
"Dearest Seb, this is the most difficult letter I've ever had to write in my life, because you were my life. But I fear the man who came to Agnew's gallery, willing to spend every penny he possessed to buy one of his sister's drawings, is not the same man I had breakfast with this morning. The man who was so proud to work alongside Cedric Hardcastle and despised everything Adrian Sloane stood for is not the same man who now feels he has no obligation to Mr. Swan, the one person who made it possible for him to receive such a handsome bonus. Have you forgotten Mr. Swan's words? If Harry Clifton is your father, that's good enough for me. If only Cedric were alive today, none of this would have happened, because you know he would have made sure you kept your side of the bargain, and if you hadn't, he would have kept it for you. I have no doubt that your career will continue to go from strength to strength, and that you will be an outstanding success at everything you do. But that's not the kind of success I want to be a part of. I fell in love with the son of Harry and Emma Clifton, the brother of Jessica Clifton, which is one of the many reasons I wanted to be the wife of Sebastian Clifton. But that man no longer exists. Despite everything, I will treasure our short time together for the rest of my life. Samantha."
Sebastian fell to his knees, the words of Sam's father ringing in his ears.
"Samantha set standards, like your mother, that the rest of us normal mortals find hard to live with, unless, like your father, they're guided by the same moral compass."
Lady Virginia Fenwick, 1966. Chapter 15.
"I'll see if her ladyship is at home," said the butler.
What a ridiculous remark, thought Lady Virginia. Morton knows only too well that I'm at home. What he actually means is, I'll find out if her ladyship wants to talk to you.
"Who is it, Morton?"
she asked, as the butler entered the room.
"Mrs. Priscilla Bingham, my lady."
"Of course I'm at home to Mrs. Bingham,"
said Virginia, picking up the phone by her side. Priscilla, darling.
Virginia, darling. It's been so long. Far too long. And I've so much to tell you.
Why don't you pop up and spend a few days in London? It would be just like old times. We can go shopping, catch a show, try out one or two new restaurants, and even visit Annabelle's, where one just has to be seen, darling.
Sounds terrific. I'll check my diary and bring you back.
Virginia put down the phone and thought about her friend. They hadn't seen much of each other since her last visit to Mablethorpe Hall, when Priscilla's husband, Robert, had behaved so badly. And worse, since then, Robert had gone over to the other side and joined the enemy. He not only sat on the board of Barrington Shipping, but had played a part in ensuring that Major Fisher, Virginia's representative, had been summarily dismissed from the board. To make matters worse, he'd insisted that Priscilla accompany him on the Buckingham's maiden voyage to New York, despite Virginia telling her that she had been refused a first-class cabin. When Priscilla returned home a fortnight later, she told Virginia that something had gone badly wrong on the first night of the voyage, but Robert refused to confide in her. Virginia vowed to get to the bottom of it, but that would have to wait because for the moment it was not Emma Clifton she had in her sights, but Bob Bingham. When Priscilla turned up at Virginia's flat a few days later, she recited a litany of disasters that had taken place during the voyage, including a dreadful dinner that she'd had to endure with that frightful social climber, Emma Clifton. The food was inedible, the wine was corked, and the staff might as well have come from Butlin's. However, Priscilla assured Virginia that on more than one occasion, she had put Mrs. Clifton firmly in her place.
"And did you find out what really happened on the first night?" asked Virginia. "No, but I did hear Robert say to one of the other directors that if the truth ever got out, the chairman would have to resign, and the company could even face bankruptcy. That would certainly help with your libel trial."
Virginia hadn't told her friend that the case was on hold because her extremely expensive lawyers considered her chances of winning not much better than 50-50, and her latest bank statement reminded her that she wasn't in a strong enough financial position to risk that. However, what she had planned for Bob Bingham was not 50-50. He would end up having to part with at least half of his entire fortune, with a twist. And once she dealt with him, Virginia would then turn her attention to Emma Clifton and the Home Fleet incident. But if her plan for Bob Bingham was to succeed, she would once again have to enlist the services of Major Alex Fisher, someone who hated the Barrington family almost as much as she did. Bob Bingham was not pleased when Priscilla announced she would be staying at their house in the Boltons for a few days, so she could spend some time with Virginia. He sensed that that woman was up to something, and it wasn't too difficult to work out what she might have in mind. The only good thing about Priscilla being away for a week was that it would give him a chance to invite Clive to join him for a few days at Mablethorpe Hall. Clive had recently been promoted and no longer relied on Bob to subsidize him. In fact, Jessica's tragic death may have been the reason he had become so fiercely independent. Bob had seen too little of his son since that dreadful night when Jessica Clifton had taken her own life, and it would never have happened if Priscilla hadn't invited that conniving woman to spend the weekend with them. It was only later that his wife admitted that Virginia had originally turned down the invitation, but had changed her mind when she heard that Jessica Clifton would be among the guests, and that Clive was planning to propose to her that weekend. Bob tried to push that vile woman out of his mind, as he wanted to concentrate on the minutes of Barrington's most recent board meeting. He agreed with young Sebastian. He must stop thinking of him in those terms. After all, he had already proved himself to be a capable director, and few of the board doubted that, in time, he would become the next chairman of the company. And if his new lifestyle was anything to go by, he was clearly doing well at Kaufman's, even if his father had hinted that his personal life was a mess. Bob Bingham and Harry Clifton had become friends during the past few years, which had seemed unlikely, considering how little they had in common, other than Jessica.